The Sydney Sentinel would like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land on which we gather and pay our respects to their elders past, present and emerging.
Welcome, everyone. You're listening to The Sentinel Speakeasy, the official podcast of the Sydney Sentinel, the independent voice of Sydney, located at sydneysentinel.com.au. It's episode 4 of season 3 of The Speakeasy, and I'm features editor and podcast producer, Travis DeJonk.
And I'm deputy editor at the Sydney Sentinel, Richie Black. We're your hosts for the next half hour or so of news, current affairs, and discussion relating to Sydney. Our special guest on the show today is Dr. Chris Woz, Associate Professor at the 50-50 by 2030 Foundation at the University of Canberra. She's an experienced expert in media and politics and has worked for a number of Australian media publications, including The Australian Financial Review, the ABC, and has also written several books, including the official biographies of some of our nation's most significant people, such as Germaine Greer, John Hewson, and Don Bradman. However, it is her 2020 book, How to Win an Election, that she joins us to discuss today. Her book is an insightful yet incredibly accessible forensic examination of the 2019 federal election. Wallace joins us to discuss her book as well as share her thoughts on the looming federal election later on in the show. But as always, first up, here are the top stories you'll find on sydneysentinel.com.au.
In an attempt to tackle one of the most pressing ongoing crises in New South Wales, the lack of affordable housing, the City of Sydney Council voted last week to create a Housing Council for All committee. The establishment of this committee comes after sustained calls for more affordable housing within the city, a call that has been heeded by the Greens after being highlighted as a major issue by residents in the recent council elections. Green City of Sydney Councillor Sylvie Elmore said local government had a strong role to play in eliminating the ongoing issue. She said the affordable housing crisis is the responsibility for all levels of government and that the City of Sydney already had a number of strong initiatives to support the growth of social housing and a percentage of affordable housing in new developments. She also told the Sentinel that the city is not currently on track to deliver against its own targets, let alone meet the calls for stronger action from the community, which is why the new Affordable Housing Committee was established at the highest levels of council. A recent study investigating the impacts of the pandemic on Australians discovered it had impacted the hopes and dreams of many through the loss of work or education. The study found participants felt powerless due to both the virus itself and actions of the federal and state governments. While attention has been drawn to mental health, other issues such as housing have been left in the dust. Now you can read this whole story at sydneysentinel.com.au.
The family of a 16-year-old Aboriginal boy who was killed in a collision with an unmarked police car have called for an independent investigation into his death. Toongari teenager Jay Wright was riding a motorbike in Alexandria the 19th of February when an unmarked police car hit him. He died the next day in hospital from his head injuries. How exactly the deadly crash happened remains unclear, as New South Wales police have given the family two contradictory stories. Jai was described by his family as a proud Aboriginal boy who everyone wanted to be around. He was about to start an apprenticeship to become an electrician. Jai died less than a week after the family of TJ Hickey led a memorial march to Redfern Police Station to mark 18 years since TJ was killed in Waterloo as part of a police chase. No police officer has been charged, and TJ's family is also calling for an independent investigation after a rushed coronial inquest cleared police of any wrongdoing despite omissions of evidence. Redfern Legal Centre on February 21st called for New South Wales Police to release its policy on safe driving and said it is shrouded in secrecy. Samantha Lee from the Redfern Legal Centre said police pursuit protocols and its safe driving policy remains hidden from public scrutiny, despite a spike in deaths following police pursuits. Lee said that New South Wales coroners have made numerous recommendations about safe driving, but it remains still unknown if New South Wales police have acted on these recommendations. For the full story, visit sydneysentinel.com.au.
A change in governance has triggered North Sydney Council to revert to its former position of opposing the Western Harbour Tunnel and Beaches Link toll roads. At last year's election, Sustainable Australia and Labor picked up two councillors each on their new 10-member council, and Baker became mayor. On the back of the election results, which saw change to the makeup of the council, as well as campaign groups such as Stop the Tunnels working hard to raise the alarm, Council Mayor Zoe Baker introduced a motion supported by Labor and Sustainable Australia, which passed unanimously. The motion noted the absence of any public benefit to be gained from the projects, plus serious environmental and public health consequences. Baker has continued to raise the alarm over the controversial projects, pointing out that 17 schools and childcare centres are close to the proposed exhaust stacks, which emit harmful pollution. According to Baker, toll roads and tunnels are not the solution, and what is needed is sustainable transport options that protect the environment and our children's health. For more on that story, visit sydneysentinel.com.au.
Local government and community groups are currently in a fierce battle with private billionaire investors accused of a blatant grab of public lands at Sydney's Moore Park. The investment group Kasinga is primarily made up of John Singleton, investment banker, Mark Carnegie, Max Moore-Wilton, Harvey Norman's Jerry Harvey, and Queen of Domain, and also Harvey's wife, Katie Page. Kasinga has redeveloped plans for the section of Moore Park known as the Entertainment Quarter to include a hotel and a 20-story office tower, as well as gifting Sydneysiders with a new 1 hectare green space. Minister for Infrastructure, Cities and Active Transport Rob Stokes, appearing at a parliamentary inquiry, said, "If a longer lease term can get a better result for the public, then it should be a longer lease." However, not everyone agrees. Greens MLC David Shoebridge said that the proposal put forward to state government from Kasinga is unsolicited and that they are engaging with a behind-the-closed-doors process with which no public engagement and no open tender process. Member for Heffron, Ron Honig, accused Kasinga, the current leaseholders of the entertainment quarter, of deliberately running down the site, using that as leverage to force the government towards their unsolicited proposal. According to independent member for Sydney, Alex Greenwich, Kasinga are presenting their proposal as $2 billion charitable gift to Sydney when it is a profit-making exercise on public land, and that it is an insult to Sydneysiders. Both the coalition government and the Labor opposition have supported Greenwich's amendments, which limit lease terms and halt unsolicited developments happening on Greater Sydney parklands. You can read the full story at sydneysentinel.com.au.
And those are just some of the top stories you'll find at the Sydney Sentinel. And a big thank you to my guest host, Richie Black, for joining us to do the headlines. For more news, as well as a huge range of arts and entertainment content, feature articles, interviews, opinion, and queer, vegan, and news content, visit sydneysentinel.com.au. You can also find us on Facebook at The Sydney Sentinel and on Instagram and Twitter, where our handle is Sydney_Sentinel. It's, of course, Sydney Gay and Lesbian Mardi Gras time here in Sydney. And, of course, our whole city is really waking up with a whole host of events out of our COVID slumber. It is really quite exciting. Despite the rain, things are going ahead. We've actually had our photographer, Anne-Marie Callahan, cover so many of those events. You will see a great galleries on our Facebook and our Instagram. Go and check them out. It's a really good time to check it out. The Sydney Sentinel on Facebook, and of course at Instagram, Sydney_Sentinel. Go and check out those galleries. You will see yourself in them and certainly get a little slice of what that colour was like at the festival so far. And now it's time for our special guest interview. I recently caught up with the media and political expert, Dr. Chris Wallace, about her book and her thoughts on the looming federal election. Let's have a listen to that interview now. Dr. Chris Wallace is Associate Professor at the 50-50 by 2030 Foundation at the University of Canberra. She has worked for a number of Australian media publications, including The Australian Financial Review, the ABC and Channel 7, amongst others. Wallace has also written several books, including the official biographies of some of our nation's most significant people, such as Jermaine Greer, John Hewson, and Don Bradman. However, it is her 2020 book, How to Win an Election, that she joins us to discuss today. Her book is an insightful yet incredibly accessible forensic examination of the 2019 federal election, which we now all know resulted in the surprise win for Scott Morrison and the Liberals, and a shocking loss for the Australian Labor Party that defied the expectations of the polls. How to Win an Election is a case study in what's going on in Australian politics today, what qualities of leadership make it across the line, and how our political processes and systems navigate the social media, news cycles, and the court of public opinion, all of which is informed by Wallace's extensive knowledge, expertise, and decades of experience. It is an absolutely essential reading, especially in the context of this looming federal election. To talk about this and a whole lot more, she joins us in the studio today, Dr. Chris Wallace. Thank you so much for joining us on the Sentinel Speakeasy.
Pleasure, Travis.
So, look, I thought we'd get stuck in straight away to How to Win an Election, which from the moment I first read it, the thing that I was really struck by was It's not a huge book. I read it in a couple of hours because it was actually that engaging. And it just makes what can be often a really dull, dry subject matter or just, people feel like it's a bit of a minefield, Australian politics can be. You make it really accessible. You break it down into really the key components of what is this all about? What is an election? How is it structured? And what makes a winner? Also, what makes a loser? It's like a 10-point action plan in an election. It's seen through the eyes of the losing candidate. And some of my favourite chapters include elect a leader who can do the substance and theatre of politics, create policy winners, not losers, and, of course, like probably the most important one, know every election is winnable. So can you tell me, like, what inspired you to write this book in the first place?
Waking up on the Sunday morning after the 2019 election and going, oh, my God, what just happened?
Yeah.
Cast your mind back, Travis. Everybody was so certain that Labor was going to win that the sports bet company, the betting agency, was paying out on a Labor win 2 days before Election Day. Now,
wow.
That's just crazy. There's never a certain election win either way until you've finished casting the last ballot.
Yeah.
And, I'm a political historian, just casting back, say, to the 1961 election, which Bob Menzies won. Mm-hmm. If 61 people had voted differently in one seat, Moreton in Queensland, Menzies would have lost and Arthur Call would have become Labor Prime Minister in 1961, right? So in democracies, every single vote counts. And, I'm glad you're so enthusiastic about politics. I hope your readers and listeners are because, all of our votes do count. They do make a difference. One of the things the bad guys in our world try to do is convince us that we're powerless, that our vote doesn't count. Yeah. That's to take us out of the game. So, really important your readers are politically engaged, so I'm glad we're talking. It was that crazy, unnecessarily stupid loss, really, in 2019 that made me think, my God, we all assume political professionals know what they're doing. But maybe it would be helpful to just touch base with the fundamentals of political craft.
Yeah.
That you have to absolutely do excellently every time across the board with no slacking in order to win, because it's very hard to win an election, especially from opposition.
Yeah. So did that come from, really the pain of that loss? Because I think a lot of us were feeling it. I mean, here was the Labor Party who, while admittedly they had, who's the leader at the time was Bill Shorten. And I remember just thinking, when you're looking at something and you think, I just don't think you've got lead. Like, you just don't have the charisma to get this over the line. But, this is the story of the Labor Party for a while now. They tend to run candidates, but and so did the Liberals in a way. Like, I remember when Tony Abbott was first proposed as Liberal Party leader, I was like, really? Oh, my God. But, apparently had more charisma.
Well, I think I know what you're getting at. This is an error that political, I'm not saying you're making an error here, but you're pointing to a common error that even political professionals make all the time, and that is they do a static analysis. So you raised Tony Abbott. I agree. Who would have ever thought that man could be elected Prime Minister of Australia? But the thing is, it's never in isolation.
Yeah, right.
It's Tony Abbott compared to the alternative.
Yeah, yeah.
And, it was in context, if you, I actually went back and analysed the last 11 federal elections.
Yeah.
And in the last three times government has changed, the person who won was more popular than the person who lost.
Yeah, right. Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah.
So it does matter. And in 2013, when Abbott won, he was less unpopular than the unpopular Kevin Rudd. Right.
Yeah,
so it's all, you know, it's a bit like, you know, you're choosing who you're going out with on a date, you know.
Yeah.
A or B, well, your choice is going to be relevant to the, you know, relative to the other person.
And it's shifting, and it's shifting details too, right? Like in terms of like leadership changes and all of that stuff that was going on at the time and the way people perceive it and the way the media depicted that. I find that really particularly interesting. I'm really glad that I'm speaking to you at this particular moment in time, because we've just had two like incredible events just happen. One was the National Press Club address by Grace Tame and Brittany Higgins, which was absolutely, you know, you were there. I've never seen the press club like that before. It was really just like, wow, right? Just when I thought we were heading in a particular trajectory with one party ahead than the other, that really kind of shifted things around a bit. And the other thing that just happened was the shelving of the religious discrimination bill. So I thought, let's talk about that for a second. Has this changed the potential trajectory of what, you know, you expected might happen in a coming up election?
I've been thinking for a while that a Labor win is more likely than not. And the thing about political forecasts is people always hold you to it on election day. That's wrong, wrong, wrong. All it means is if there was an election held this Saturday, I think Anthony Albanese would win.
Yeah,
it's been an absolutely extraordinary week in Australian politics. Like, just, as you say, just wow. It was an historic occasion, the press club lunch that Grace Tame and Brittany Higgins addressed. And, you know, two young women who have changed the political narrative and really had a super high impact on Australian politics, two women in their 20s, have really been game changers in national politics.
Mm-hmm.
Comes back to our, you know, what we're talking about at the beginning. Yeah. Everybody's got a vote. Everybody's a citizen. Everybody's got a right to have their say. And to have these two extraordinary 20-something women hold a prime minister to account repeatedly, visibly, powerfully, effectively, and contribute to a likely loss by the Morrison government is extraordinary. You know, it really gives you a lot of hope for the future. In terms of the religious discrimination bill, again, wow, finally a few so-called moderates in the Liberal Party stood up and voted with Labor to take out that bill in effect and stop Scott Morrison culminating the big love game he's been playing with Australian Christian lobby and others. Yeah. Wow, you know, it's the power of individual courage, collective action, and close listening by people who care. It's an extraordinary combination, and that's politics, Travis.
Yeah, it makes me excited that people actually, you know, are, you know, putting polls and things aside, putting pressures from lobby groups aside, and actually going, well, this is something that really matters to me, and I can't in all conscience go along with it. I mean, that was really exciting to me to see those people, because, you know, like on both sides of politics, there are some really, really great politicians, and then there are some that are just, you know, sycophants and the rest. So it was really good to see that. One of the things I say, my flatmate up till recently wasn't actually enrolled to vote, even though he's 30. And I was always encouraging him, like, please get enrolled to vote, you know, because because they, politicians ultimately don't care about the people that aren't voting. They only care about the ones that are. So it is, like you said, quite a powerful thing. And realising, one of the things when reading your book, I realised how small the margin is that's required for a win. So a two-seat majority is all that Scott Morrison had.
And that seems crazy. Plenty of governments govern with in minority now too. I mean, the Perrottet government is in a minority. The Morrison government effectively is too.
Yeah.
You know, it might be worth Sydney Sentinel having a standing ad between now and the election, because a lot of your readers and listeners are in Wentworth, and that's a critical swing seat. So, you've got an important public interest role to play there.
Well, we're certainly getting into that mode. I mean, certainly during the local council elections, we spoke to every candidate that was running, at least in the city of Sydney, gave them a bit of a voice and a platform. I think, you know, it's really about giving people choices. I mean, I have personal political leanings, like as do my colleagues, but we're really about kind of giving people choices and access to kind of, you know, like just switching people onto like what matters to you as a community. And it's, I think ultimately,
a lot of the time we don't appreciate how basic the level of information needed is, though. Mm-hmm. So, for example, if you guys explained how to register to vote, if you're not registered, right?
Yeah.
You know, in federal elections, a crucial thing is which side gets out the postal vote most effectively.
Yeah.
Right? So it's all these little things that add up, that accumulate into whether you win or whether you lose.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I think opinions, in a way, like having people such as yourself talking about these moments, having discussions about it. I mean, I couldn't help but reflect over the last few days on the whole Scott Morrison coming into power thing. And I went back to that, the time of the bushfires, which to me was just like such a critical moment, and something that's, here's Australia having bushfires on the west and the east, everywhere, like catastrophic conditions. And our Prime Minister goes on holiday, which, you know, is entitled to do. But, you know, just when you need leadership, he's not there. And I feel like that's somewhat emblematic of his leadership style since then, right? Whenever you need dad, he's not in the house, right? And
that's a very good way of putting it.
So, yeah, yeah. And I just,
you're under politics, Travis.
No, thanks. I'm much like the ladies that spoke the other day. I'm much like, I think I like being outside it. You know, it just gives me a bit more of an objective view. And much like yourself, I think it's important to be an observer. So, look, let's talk about this looming federal election. What kind of directions do you see things going? I mean, we've had a couple of major things that, you know, potentially change the future. What do you think will happen?
I think there's going to be an almighty campaign by the Morrison government, or possibly the Frydenberg government or Dutton government, because there's no certainty. So weak is the Prime Minister's position right now. No certainty he will in fact survive to lead the coalition into the election. But whoever's leader, you'll see a massive attack on Anthony Albanese. They'll accuse him of various dire things in a desperate attempt to kind of tear down the idea that Labor's a plausible alternative government. It will be extremely ugly. It'll be multi-pronged.
Yeah.
And I think Anthony Albanese, as he's developed over time in the opposition leadership, I think he's just going to let it slide off. You know, I don't think it's going to affect him.
It is a very interesting style that he's going for at the moment. Actually, you know, even both sides are really, like, what they seem to be doing is minimising any problematic discussion and just really, like, I know Labor still hasn't revealed much, but they're kind of just really keeping it all under a hat, which is that working for them? Because I think there's a perception that, you know, maybe they don't have policy ideas and maybe the only way they get across the line is not being Scott Morrison.
Yeah. Actually, Labor has a number of really good, strong policies. Mm-hmm. It has struggled to communicate them. Yeah. And that's partly the failure of political communications, you know, not being good enough at communicating. Though I've got to say Albanese has really got a lot better at that. It's been a failure of encapsulating the message into something short, memorable and repeatable. Mm-hmm. And, of course, that was Tony Abbott's genius in 2013, stop the boats, axe the tax and whatever the third one was. It'd be really great if Albanese Labor could encapsulate in a kind of boom, boom, boom way that everyone can hear and remember his three key offerings. I expect they'll do that in the campaign through advertising. Would have been better if it had been happening earlier, but still, you know. And again, what we don't appreciate fully is most people aren't tuned into politics the way probably you and I are.
Mm-hmm.
Most people start to pay a bit of attention during an election, particularly the last week, and especially in the last day or two. Yep. So you'll see political advertising really kind of coming in and just funneling in to concentrate on that last period. And it'll just be a massive attack on Albanese, massive smear campaign. It'll be very relevant whether Morrison leads the government into the election or Dutton or Frydenberg. It's the fear of many people in the Labor Party that Morrison will in fact get knocked off.
Yeah.
Frydenberg or Dutton will become leader and get a honeymoon and have a snap election.
Yeah.
And most people won't know who the hell
what
leaders, and it'll be a matter of whether the coalition attack on Albanese is enough to take Labor down. But, you know, political pros say during an election campaign, which is generally 5 weeks long, you get the chance to communicate one or maybe two ideas to voters.
Mm-hmm.
And if you've done that, actually you've done really well. So you got to make sure they're the right ideas. And the first idea is got to be, I'm a person who could safely lead the nation and take care of you between now and the next election. It's a very visceral, animal-based kind of thing, and that's why you'll see a massive attack on Albanese.
Yeah.
And you won't see the reverse because the government's really kind of destroying itself, isn't it, through its performance and meanness and nothing.
And do you think
the religious discrimination bill?
I mean, do you think that approach will work? Because, you know, part of the thing is, like, I see, you know, people who are good at the catchphrases, they come back with the things, you know, Anthony over easy, blah, blah, blah. You know, like, I mean, it seems like that charisma and that kind of showmanship is pretty critical. I mean, I think would Albanese be a good leader for the country? I think absolutely. I think he'd be a great leader in terms of policy, in terms of he's a great bloke. He's really got sound politics. But if you need the theatre to get over the line, is that going to, you know, does he have that?
Well, many people have asked that every day since he got elected, right? And are there more charismatic leadership alternatives? Yes, there are. But he is the leader, and none of the alternatives wanted to or were willing to or were going to launch the kind of campaign you need to dislodge a leader.
Yeah.
And that, in a way, is a good reflection on those people. They're not plotters and stabbers.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of an unbalanced thing, though, because if that makes Labor less likely to win in a tight election, then you would wish maybe they'd done something about that. But you can say at this point Albanese has played a very clever strategic game. He said he'd be kicking with the wind in the fourth quarter. He's right. And he has done an excellent job at stopping Labor making dumb-ass errors that made it the target. And by protecting the opposition from that, Albanese has caused the spotlight to be entirely on the government and its bumbling failures on everything from bushfires to the stroll out to the boosters to the blah, blah, you know, and that's taken a lot of political discipline and skill and was partly possible because the alternative, more charismatic leaders kept their batons firmly zipped up in their knapsacks and were loyal and cooperated and did the right thing. And as a result, you're right, there are more charismatic possible leaders, but Albanese has got Labor in a very strong potential winning position now.
Yeah.
And he's got to see it through the next couple of months.
Yeah. My favourite thing about what he seems to be doing is that he's in the right place at the right time. He is going to those regional centres. He is going and meeting people on the ground. And he did turn up to the National Press Club yesterday to hear a couple of days ago, to hear that incredible address. He was present, you know, at a time where, again, where the Prime Minister hasn't been. And I think that, like, my presence is perhaps maybe the strategy that he seems to be using. What will be the defining issues of this election? What do you think people are going to be looking at?
Well, it was about, you know, you raised the Brittany Higgins Grace Tame lunch. Grace Tame had a spectacular answer when one journalist asked, "Tell me, Ms. Tame, what specifically could Anthony Albanese do in government that Wilson hasn't that would be better?" And Grace Tame, who is so brilliant at the one line, she's so smart, said, "All Anthony Albanese has to do is none of the things Scott Morrison does to be a fantastic Prime Minister." So we'll put Labor to one side. I mean, Labor's campaign is going to be Anthony Albanese is a safe, decent, sensible alternative Prime Minister with a positive set of policies focusing on things like job security, free childcare, doing something about climate, doing something about energy infrastructure, so and on and on.
Yeah.
So he'll present a picture of being, it's okay to switch to me, you know, it's safe. On the other side, the coalition's going to try and completely destroy that idea and paint him as a, you know, political extremist, incompetent and inexperienced. Not true. He was a cabinet minister for years, ran transport and infrastructure portfolio. Manager of government business in the House, he's phenomenally experienced. But the other thing they're going to try and do is create a massive scare campaign around foreign policy and defence policy that basically, you know, they're going to argue Labor is weak on defence, is the captive of China. Of course, this is complete rubbish.
It worked
for Menzies in the 50s, and, you know, I think it's a pretty desperate ploy by the government. You know, it shows how kind of low their stocks are that they've got to rely on that. The other line they're developing is, you know, they always argue Labor is a higher taxing government when, in fact, when you do the data over the last 50 years, taxes as a share of GDP have always been lower under Labor governments than the coalition. But, you know, Labor hasn't communicated that well enough. So you see a massive attack alleging Albo will have an inheritance tax and, you know, blah, 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 none of which are true. So it'll be, you know, a smashing emotional campaign of lies trying to destroy Albanese against a very sensible, moderate, easygoing campaign that says, look, elect us, we'll be sensible, we're going to do safe, sensible things, the things you need for job security, better childcare, better climate, etc.
Yeah.
And there's a bit of a wild card in all this because there's probably going to be more independence too.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I mean, that kind of really excites me because I feel like we're living through this, either the time of the independence, where people, you know, like I think they're a bit over party politics and sort of, you know, there's the particular powers that they might happen to have, and people are sort of more about issues now, like, you know, they're about what does this person stand for, and it's kind of easier to gauge that from a independent. Interesting point. I sort of have this horrible feeling that, I mean, and I really hope I'm wrong. What I'm imagining is Scott Morrison gets it across the line and then he bows out politely because he wouldn't, you know, that I don't think he, I think at any cost he'd like to avoid any sort of usurping. And then, you know, bow down politely. And because I feel like they've been polishing up Peter Dutton really hard, like really hard. And we're going to end up with him, and that's like my worst nightmare. So let's hope that doesn't happen. Onto maybe more positive and better things, I want to talk to you just very briefly about two things. One is, what is 50-50 by 2030 Foundation? And also we'll talk about some projects that you might have coming up that you're excited about.
So the 50-50 by 2030 Foundation at the University of Canberra is an initiative set up some years ago. It probably needs to change its name to 40-40-20 Foundation, I think. But it's designed to try and get gender equity in public sector leadership positions, yeah, in politics, in the public service, and universities, mm-hmm, by 2030. And my role there is to work out what do you got to do to actually change things. There's an awful lot of research in universities that does fine-grained analysis of what's happening and what has happened, but not a lot of focus on how you actually change things. So that's my gig. How do we actually change stuff?
Yeah.
And oftentimes it's clear what needs to be done, but people won't do it. So then the question is, how do you do it? And, of course, the classic case is, and again, this came up at the Grace Tame Brittany Higgins Press Club lunch this week, the classic example is quotas in politics.
Mm. Yeah, it did. Yeah.
Gender quotas came in the Labor Party a few decades ago. They've now got 50-50 effectively gender equity in their federal political representation.
Yeah.
The Liberal and National parties don't.
Mm. And they struggle with that, don't they? I think they really struggle to.
They struggle for a reason.
Yeah, exactly. You can almost see it. You can see it in the room. Yeah.
So they've actually gone backwards, and they're in fact dragging. One of the big reasons Australia is sinking in the world global gender equity rankings is partly because about 20 years ago, female representation amongst federal coalition MPs peaked, and it's been going down ever since.
Yeah.
So now you've got a situation, because the coalition parties don't have quotas, where in the Labor Party it's 50-50. In the coalition party, it's 75% blokes, right? So people wonder why they come up with such, you know, out of touch and often hostile to policies that people like men. There's part of the answer.
I love their argument of, like, you know, merit-based systems, as if to say, like, that, like, I couldn't possibly be a woman who's qualified to sit in those seats or to contest those seats. One of the things that I was really struck by at the press club was, Laura Tingle actually said it. She said it slapped her in the face that gender equity and the treatment of women, especially in Canberra and, you know, highest office in the land, isn't a federal election issue. And I just thought, wow, you know, we talk about economics, we talk about the environment, and I just think, like, here's this thing that's just sitting there, so glaring, and that's really brought that home for me. And I know this is backtracking a bit, but do you think that's going to make a difference this year?
I think it is actually going to make a very big difference, even if you don't see it actively raised often during the campaign. Mm-hmm. And that the reason is women have really done it tough. You know, when you looked at the pandemic lockdowns and the analysis of what happened, you know, everyone stayed home. What happened? Domestic violence went through the roof. The victims were mostly women. Suddenly there was this huge amount of extra labour, schooling and domestic labour. Everyone's at home. Who disproportionately did it? Women. And they have not forgotten that when the Prime Minister first took Australia out of the big lockdown in 2020, the first time we came out of a really big lockdown, the first policy thing he did was withdraw federal government subsidies for childcare fees, which had enabled many people for the first time to have their kids in childcare without the desperate anxiety of how the hell am I going to pay my childcare fees?
Yeah.
So I think you know, it's not like this is going to be a billboard up in lights issue during the election, but I think it's conditioned so many people's understanding of just how deeply gendered and hostile to women the government has been.
Yeah.
And I remember when the Keating government lost office in 1996, people talked about voters in Queensland waiting on the verandas with baseball bats, you know, waiting to get the government. I suspect, I suspect that's the kind of background sentiment, atmospheric, that female voters are going to take into the ballot box. Whatever they end up voting, I think that's the kind of...
They're galvanised. I really feel like that because, you know, I mean, I just feel like things have been actually really bad for women for a long time and normalised in our society. It's like almost like it's an Aussie thing to you know, have that kind of particular perspective on women. And, hey, we don't really mean it, but...
Well, I think it's interesting. You know, I've got a bit of a thing about people say, referring to we, and you've just referred to Australia, but it's actually not we or Australia. It's the coalition parties, right?
Yeah, right.
Because the Labor Party's largely not like that. They changed their culture by embracing quotas and now having gender equity in the party room. And Travis, this is the great thing. You can change things for the better. Now, you know, we look at the independents that are popping up this election. They're all in coalition seats. They're not taking on Labor MPs. And these independents are mostly the sensible, small L liberal, you know, kind of moderate centrist type people who 30 years ago, before John Howard and then Scott Morrison spent so much energy driving anybody showing any difference at all out of the coalition to the fullest extent possible, these people, you know, like Zali Steggall is a classic, would have been members of the moderate wing of the Liberal Party. But the right-wingers made it a hostile place for anyone who wasn't a white man, white straight man in a suit.
Yeah.
Unless you're a white straight man in a suit, you are not welcome in the LNP. That's been the message if you're inside that side of politics for 30 years. So, you know, Zali could have easily been a moderate Liberal MP. And, you know, the state Liberal Party, it's got Matt Keane. I mean, completely reasonable bloke who gets sensible policies up. I mean, they used to exist federally, but not anymore.
There's some great people. And, I mean, that's the thing about, like, what I'm realising now is that, you know, parties mean different things in different states and different locations. You know, they certainly Liberals come in different flavours and so do Labor Party people. And that's a really interesting thing to learn, that the dynamics are the same in each state and that there are great people on either side. And, you know, when it really comes down to it, it's not a left or right thing. It's just about the kinds of sets of values that you might have. Like, sometimes I think they get relegated to extremism and I think there are those people, but I think
no matter how you vote in Australia, it's in everyone's interest for the Liberal and National parties to sort themselves out because right now they look too much like and are too much like in their policies a bunch of white male extremists governing for a narrow section of Australia instead of for all Australians. And, I mean, if you had to come right down to what's the difference between the two sides of the election, that's the difference. Labor is trying to do stuff for everybody, whereas the LNP is trying to do stuff for people who look just like them.
Well, that's terrifying. Let's talk about things that you're working on at the moment. Anything exciting that you're working on that you're excited about?
Well, I'm excited about working out how you actually change things structurally. So what are you going to do? I think this going back to quotas, it's such a great example, right? So, you know, take the public service. Say you want to get genuine diversity, equity and inclusion policies going there. Are we going to do it through more training programs? No.
Hmm.
Are we going to get it through, you know, praying? No. What are the things that are actually going to change it fundamentally? Hmm. So that's what I'm working on. And it's hard because human beings have a lot of hope and we tend not to have good historical perspective. So there's a lot of reinventing of the wheel. There's a lot of if we train, have enough training sessions or we, you know, talk about it enough or we have positive image campaigns, it'll fundamentally change things. So what it does is improves things slightly at the margin for a while and then falls back, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So how do we actually make the world more diverse?
Yeah.
Give more, spread the power more, stop the concentration in a narrow set of hands. How do we include people, genuinely include them, not just have them in the room and actually listen, take notice. It doesn't matter what policy area you look at this.
Yeah.
In relation to it is the vital change that's got to happen.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's a bit like trying to solve the nuclear fusion problem. It's really hard, but that sounds like my days.
I see what you mean. And it's funny, I'm increasingly having this conversation with nearly everyone that I speak to across the board, particularly that I interview for the show. Just a few days ago, I was speaking with Mardi Gras CEO Albert Kruger, and we're talking about this exact same thing. How do we make it so that it's not just, hey, we just had Diversity Day, what are you talking about? You know, how do we make real meaningful, you know, get people to kind of get it and just understand that it's fundamentally about respect and it's not one person is better than the other? Really key questions, and I guess the stuff that you're doing through your foundation. I could talk to you about this all day. There's so much to talk about, and it's such a pleasure to speak with you.
Vote early, vote often.
I absolutely encourage everybody to vote and get involved and just find that thing that you really care about and see who is doing anything about it and make sure that you give them your vote. I think it just comes down to that, right? It's no more complex than that.
Sound advice.
Yeah. Chris Wallace, thank you so much for joining us on the Sentinel Speakeasy.
Pleasure.
And that was Dr. Chris Wallace in conversation with me, Travis DeJonk. Her book, How to Win an Election, is out now, and the details are in our podcast. That brings us to the end of this episode. New episodes of the Sentinel Speakeasy go to air every Tuesday from 5 p.m. You can tune in on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Buzzsprout, or wherever you get your podcasts. And remember, for One News, as well as a huge range of arts and entertainment content, feature articles, news, opinion, and queer, vegan, and news content, visit sydneysentinel.com.au. You can also find us on Facebook at The Sydney Sentinel, on Instagram at Sydney_Sentinel, and likewise on Twitter. And now is a really great time. Go and check out all those great galleries we have from Sydney Gay and Lesbian Mardi Gras. Thanks so much for joining us, and a special thanks to Richie Black for co-hosting with me. We will catch you next week. Bye for now.